Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, acclaimed writers Renee Watson and Jambari Asim talk about Watson's novel, Skin and Bones, as well as writing Black history and moving from writing for children to adults. The following conversation originally took place May 19th, 2024, and was recorded live at the American Writers Festival.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our final program. In Renee Watson's new novel, Skin and Bones, the number one selling young adult author moves into writing for adults with a story that explores sisterhood, motherhood, and whose stories society makes space for. Renee Watson has authored 15 young adult books, which have collectively sold more than a million copies. She received a Coretta Scott King Award and a Newbery Honor for Piecing Me Together, and high praise for 1619 Project, Born on the Water. Joining her to talk about Skin and Bones is Jambari Asim, writer, multidisciplinary artist, and author of Yonder, The N-Word, and We Can't Breathe. He's the member of American Writer Museum's Board of Directors. Welcome.
Good afternoon, everyone. So glad you could all come out. And I'm guessing you may even be as glad as I am to have this conversation with Renee Watson. Renee, so happy to be here with you.
Thank you.
About this new book. It's a departure for you in some ways because you're writing for a different audience.
Yes.
But it also covers some of the themes that you've addressed so well in earlier books. So,
thank you.
And I know you don't want to like go into a detailed synopsis of it. You would rather read some opening pages.
Sure, I'll read some opening. Hello, everyone. Thank you all for joining, and thank you. I'm very honored to be in conversation with you. So Skin and Bones is about Lena Baker. I'm going to start from the very beginning, so I won't do too much setup, but what I would like you to know is that she is a dark-skinned Black woman who lives in Portland, Oregon. I wanted the book to feel weighted, and so we moved the margins in so that you could kind of experience what it's like for this big woman to take up space in a space that's not made for her. So she's squeezed in often, and so in the book, the words feel squeezed in, which makes the book feel a little longer and heavier than it actually is, so that you could kind of feel what it's like to be Lena. And I'm going to skip around from the first chapter where she is at a doctor's visit. The weight I carry. I don't want to die fat. There would no doubt be whispers at the repast. It's too bad she didn't take better care of herself. They will speculate, assume, diabetes, heart attack. If I die fat, I hope I die in a car accident or go missing and turn up bloated and bloodied in a river. No one will mention my weight then. I will die without conversation about the obesity epidemic, and my family and friends can grieve without the added guilt from flashbacks of every time they wanted to say something about the pounds I was putting on, but didn't. Because here's the thing. I am not thick or big-boned or voluptuous. I am fat, obese, morbidly obese. That's what the nurse just typed into my chart. She is a wafer of a woman, the kind of woman who looks like she'll fall over should a big wind blow. This is the woman typing in the word morbid to describe my body. Everything about me is big, big and Black, big and majestic like the ocean. Every bit of me hard to contain. My belly spills over, and so do my tears, and so does my joy, and every family recipe, and every heartache, and every weekend spent at Seaside Beach. It's all here with me, heavy. It's all here, sitting on this table, the thinnest layer of tissue paper under me, holding all this bigness, all this Blackness. I feel the tissue paper rip under me. Wonder why they don't make it more sturdy. I pull the two small gown together as best I can. It is tight around my flabby arms and doesn't cover my breast or stretch-marked stomach. I might as well be sitting here naked. You would think doctors' offices would carry large robes for their patients. Don't patients come in all sizes? The nurse doesn't realize that I can see what she's typed. She enters the words so matter-of-fact, And in the space for more notes, she types, morbidly obese, but seems happy, dressed well, good hygiene. I stare at the word, but. Morbidly obese, but. She types again. I look away. Can I take the urine sample now? I really have to go. I've been holding it. We'll get to that. Give me just a moment. First, I need to take your blood pressure and temperature. She checks my temperature. My arm tightens to the point it feels like it's going to explode. And then when she lets the air out, my arm relaxes. Wow, pretty great numbers, she says, like she is surprised, like she expected there to be an issue. Okay, I'm going to get the doctor now. Give her just a moment. While I wait, I fidget with the platinum miracle on my left hand. 2 more weeks and I'll be Miss Lena Wilson, wife of Malcolm Wilson. God, please let this bladder infection pass quickly. I've got a honeymoon to Hawaii to be ready for. I twist the ring, trace the diamond with the tip of my finger. That skinny nurse didn't have a ring on her finger. I hate that I just had this thought. I do not want to wear this engagement ring like an Olympic medal, hard fought for, hard won. But it does feel like an accomplishment. I did work for this. Finally, I am here. Malcolm is my prize, and I am his. I look down at my dangling feet, thinking about the words the nurse used to describe me. Morbidly obese, but seems happy. Dressed well. Good hygiene. Glad I got that pedicure yesterday. My toes are painted a bright cantaloupe color, my heels smooth and silky. I always leave the house casket ready. I got that from Mom, who everyone calls honey. Whenever I'd leave the house, she'd ask, "You got on clean clothes?" And I knew she was not talking about my shirt or jeans or socks. She was asking about my bra and panties. If you get in a car accident, you don't want to be unladylike when the paramedics come. Always a lesson from honey and grandma about taking care of myself, but never for myself. Just when I decide to find a cup and go to the bathroom, the Dr. Knox comes in. "And what brings you here today, Lena?" she asks, not looking at me. She scrolls through my file, reading while I talk. "I think I have a bladder infection. I get them often since I was a child, so I kind of know the symptoms." "And your symptoms are?" "Peeing every 5 minutes, and it hurts every time, like it does when people have bladder infections." "Oh, okay, well, I'd like to check your blood sugar, too." Have you been tested for diabetes?" "No, I haven't, but today I'm here. I think I have a bladder infection, and I came to do the urine sample, so if we could get that going, that would be great, because I really have to go." "Yes, we'll get to that, but I need to check a few other things. A woman your size, it could be something else." She says she wants to review my family history. I want to tell her what's not on that chart. She wants medical history, physical ailments, but I think she should know it all. The almost dead, the died too soons, the divorces, the births, rebirths, stillbirths, the car accidents, graduations, holiday dinners, the first days of school, last days of childhood, every birthday, every happy hour, every 4th of July picnic at Blue Lake Park, baptisms, breakdowns, excruciating laughter, electric slide at up all night house parties. What's been passed down is Aunt Aretha's recipe for lemon pound cake that must be made for every arrival and departure of breath. She asks for my family history. I could tell her, but I know better. The non-wafer, non-morbid woman leaves, comes back with a plastic cup. Finally, the urine sample. Then waiting and waiting and waiting. Another knock and the words, "Bladder infection, antibiotics." "And the blood sugar," I ask. "Normal, but you need to be careful carrying all that weight. I recommend trying to lose at least 5 to 10% of your body weight, and then we can reassess and put you on a weight loss plan." My doctor wants to put me on a weight loss plan, even though my test results are normal. Before she leaves the room, she offers an affirmation. "You know," she starts, "you are a beautiful woman. I hope you know that. Your skin, your hair, just gorgeous." I smile, kind of. Yeah, this is a smile. A thank you? I open my mouth to say something, to correct her, scold her, to ask her why she felt the need to tell me she thinks I am pretty. But my words do not come. Only her words are here. They are hanging in the stale, sanitized room. When I leave, they come with me. Words are like that. They follow, linger, stay a while. Here I am, carrying what is not mine. Heavy.
Amazing. I want to jump around a little bit in the questions. I have a certain order, but then listening to you read, I thought of other things.
Okay.
When I teach writing, one of the things I emphasize is that the beginning is so important because the writer only has so many pages to capture the reader's attention. And I was thinking, now I'm going to use that book as the model for how to do that.
Well, thank you.
But it raises questions for me. So I want to know about your drafts.
Mm-hmm.
Like, was that always the beginning, or did that come later?
It was always, that sentence was always the first sentence.
Okay.
I do not want to die fat. The scene and how she was going to keep thinking that over and over and what makes her think that, I played around with a little bit. But I always knew that that would be the first sentence of the novel. I don't know why. It came to me and I just wanted to keep it. So all the revisions, and there were many, that one, that sentence always stayed. I really wanted to establish, I wanted you all to meet her in a moment where she is having to hold on to her like own dignity, and kind of there's a theme throughout the book of her finding her voice and knowing when to speak up and when to be quiet and how she's going to navigate being a Black woman, being a big Black woman. And sometimes if you're saying something all the time, it can be exhausting, but sometimes you really do need to speak up. And so she's figuring that out, and I wanted the reader to have to be in it with her immediately.
So one of the things that I heard about this manuscript is that it began as a play.
Yes.
And so, you know, at first I was surprised, then I was like, why would I be surprised, right? Because two of the things that you do really well are monologues and dialogue, right? Which, you know, plays depend on.
Mm-hmm.
And I was tantalized because now I want to see your work on stage.
Oh.
And so I realize you're very prolific and therefore very busy. But is there a chance that you will adapt this for the theater, and have you continued to create plays?
So I never say no to what is coming. I don't have a plan right now to adapt it, but I would love to. I always just say I'm a storyteller. So however the story comes to me is how I want to tell it. So sometimes it's poetry, sometimes it's a picture book, or it's an adult novel, a young adult novel. So yeah, I don't limit myself in that regard. I would love to go back to the stage. I used to write plays and poetry mostly. Like, that is what I was known for back home. I grew up in Portland, Oregon. I went to performing arts schools. You kind of had to choose a focus. And my focus was theater. That is what I loved, and I think everyone thought I was going to go into that direction. So yes, I would love to return to theater and write a play and direct it or be involved in some way, for sure.
That would be awesome. and we have witnesses, so.
Yes, hold me accountable. And if anybody want to help me do it, let me know.
keeping with that theatrical theme, Lena is the central character, but I think it's fair to call it an ensemble.
Yes, which is my theater background, I think. Okay, I love an ensemble cast.
Mm-hmm. So you give space and agency and voice to various personalities in the novel. And in your talks, you often praise the power of communities, community support. And your comments around that resonated with me while I was reading. Can you tell us about your narrative strategy in Skin and Bone, this decision to share Lena's spotlight by offering other characters' perspectives?
So I am who I am because of the community that raised me, and that includes my immediate family, so my mother, my siblings, and then extended family, aunties, uncles, cousins, church folks in the larger neighborhood. And I have the best friends. I say this a lot. I have sisters who are like friends and friends who are like sisters. So I don't know a world in which I could survive without the people around me. And so Lena needs her people. She needs this village of folks around her to survive what she's going through. The book is very much about what do we inherit and then what are we going to pass on. And some stuff she needs to let go of. But there are things that she wants to give to her daughter. And so she's figuring that out in community with other women who are wrestling with those questions too. And then quite, like, frankly, like, as a writer. So that was kind of my, like, the emotional part of what I write. I want to make sure giving space to community, to Black women, how we nurture each other. But I also did not want Lena to become a kind of, like, she is speaking for all big Black women, or she is speaking for Black folks in Portland, Oregon. So to have two friends with her, there's, like, three main characters, Lena, Kendra, and Aspen, to have them all feel like main characters and all be dark-skinned and all be big, they're different sizes within bigness, allowed me to not have her be like a caricature. No one's the big, sassy Black girl because they're all big and Black. So I didn't have to think about who's going to be the stereotype in here, because I'm messing with all the nuances of what it's like for these three different-sized but all big women navigating a very white city. So in that way, I wanted a cast too, so we could just see the different perspectives within that identity.
So was there a plan of any, because sometimes Aspen's sharing her point of view, mm-hmm. sometimes Kendra is. So what was your design, if that's the right word, for deciding, okay, now Kendra's gonna tell us a little something about what's going on with her mm-hmm. or Aspen.
Yeah, so Lena's the main character, but I wanted them all to be able to take up space. She takes up the most, because, and she is the biggest. And so I really was thinking about how do the words look on the page, and who am I letting speak the most? Who would get to speak the most in real life? And that person would most likely be Aspen, because she's the thinnest of the three. So she doesn't talk as much in the book. If you were to look through the book and find moments of Aspen's backstory, or when she's the one talking, or the story's following her, her dating life even, we see her, but not as much. We see quite a bit of Kendra, but not as much. And then we see a lot of Lena. And so, yes, I was thinking about kind of the metaphor of that, what that would look like on the page, and then just thinking, how do their stories complement each other? I think I get to know you by the people who love you and the stories mm-hmm. they tell about you. Mm-hmm. I get to know you by who I watch you tolerate and who I watch you forgive, So you are getting to know Lena in her interactions with her friends. You learn about her. So I also was thinking, I don't want a wasted scene. So you can't just learn about Aspen. You're only learning about Aspen so that you find out something about Lena too, so that no word is wasted in that way.
Okay. So we're learning something about the narrative design, the strategy. Mm-hmm. So sort of want to circle around that. I've had the privilege of interviewing a number of writers on this topic. Some of them say, for example, they might say, well, I decided that Aspen would have less to say, but she kept talking, so I wrote it down, right? And then there are other writers I interview say, well, I don't allow that because I'm the author and I control what the character. Like, okay, all right, no offense, right? So,
yes.
So, what is your relationship with these characters in that regard?
Oh, that is such a good question. I think it was both. There was some push and pull. There were definitely all of my characters in anything I write, they surprise me, right? Mm-hmm. So I want to come to the page with a plan, but I want to be open. Because I think if you come to the page with a plan and you only stick to that plan, you're preaching to the reader. You have something to say and you're trying to say it. So maybe you should write an essay or mm-hmm. make a speech. Mm-hmm. If you are telling a story and you want these characters to evolve and grow, I want my characters to speak to me first, because how could I expect them to speak to you if I'm not even listening to them? So the story takes shape in ways that I am surprised by. So it's a little bit of both. I have a plan, but I'm going to let my characters also guide me. So the character that surprised me the most, or I feel like that said, wait a minute, I have something to say, is actually Aaliyah, who is the 8-year-old daughter. In early drafts, she was present. And it was because that there's this theme of our young people are listening, and they are watching us, and they hear what we're saying. And what are we saying, right, about race, about beauty, about love and relationships? This little girl, she's soaking it all up, and you see how that plays out for her. So I had her in scenes where she's listening to these grown women have really grown conversations, but she wasn't saying a whole lot. And I think, I don't know, maybe the fourth or fifth draft, her voice started to emerge, and then that took on a whole nother part of the story and deepened it in a way that I'm grateful for and was very surprised by, because she was not that big of a character in earlier drafts.
Okay, so I want to kind of like stay on that theme in some way. One of the things I appreciate about your work, Renee, is the way it enters in conversation with other works. So in Skin and Bone, Lena's mother, Honey, talks about, quote, every black woman who came before you and survived, which is a really powerful phrase. And it made me think about so many African-American authors who've addressed similar things. I couldn't help thinking of, for example, the black women gathered at the climax of Beloved. Similarly, when Honey discusses her imperfections and her priorities as a mother, I thought about Eva Peace talking to Hannah and Sula, and I thought about Troy Maxson talking to his son in Fences, where these parents are trying to outline for their children, I did this because of this, I messed up here, whatever, right? So who were some of the writers who inspired and or influenced you as you began your writing journey?
Oh, I always say I wouldn't be the writer I am or the woman I am without Gwendolyn Brooks, Lucille Clifton, Nikki Giovanni, Margaret Walker, Maya Angelou. I grew up reading poetry because that's where I first saw my mirrors. Like, we talk about that a lot, especially in children's lit. And I love to read, and I've read books and novels and all that, but when I really felt seen and validated is when those poets were speaking to me. And so I think there were, I mean, Lucille's work, the book opens up with the Lucille Clifton quote, and there is a place in the book, like a museum gallery space that's for the community that has all these classes and workshops for local people to come to, and it's called Starshine and Clay, which is a line from Lucille's poem.
Yeah.
So yeah, their work definitely girds me. As a writer, it taught me how to write, right? And what to write about, and that I could explore my body, I could explore joy, I could explore pain, all of that could live in my body of work. But also when I listen to interviews by them, or I just see how they moved in the world, that is, for me, what is most important is who they were as people. I've learned so much by them. So yes, their work for sure, but just these black women who were thriving and surviving in a world that was not always welcoming to them and for their voices before a hashtag of black girl, you are magic and all the things that we have now to lean on. They didn't have that. Mm-hmm. So I'm very encouraged by their legacies.
And we can even hear some of those rhythms. I think when you were reading it, there are parts that sound like poetry.
Right? I hope so.
But I mean, you write poetry, so I know that's no accident. I wanted to know, would you be okay with reading us another passage?
Sure. You brought up Honey's what she says, so I'll read what Honey says. The book is exploring motherhood and legacy and what we pass down. And, when I was younger, I could critique the mess out of the mentors and the youth pastor and my aunts and my mom and what they could have done better and should have done better. And then I turned 25 and 30 and so on, and I'm like, we're all still learning, even though we are adults and that you make mistakes and that sometimes the people who love you also hurt you. And how do you hold that truth that I can be hurt by someone that I love or that I can do the hurting and know that I deeply love this person? And how do you own up to that instead of just saying, well, I did the best I could? like, what is the balance of that? So this is a conversation that comes at a really hard moment that Lena has given some feedback to her mother. And this is what her mother says. And her mother, they call her Honey. What Honey says, you think I didn't notice that year after year, your size went up and up when we'd go shopping? I didn't ignore that. I chose to affirm you. I knew there would be enough people pointing out every pound, commenting on your weight. I knew you'd have a lifetime of diets and exercise if you wanted to do that. I knew you could learn that on your own. But loving yourself, I taught you that. That took priority. I made sure you were clean, that your hair was done, that your clothes were cute and fit just right. And what did I say to you every single morning? Huh? What did I say? I said, good morning, beautiful. From the time you were a day old to the day you moved out of my house for college, I woke you up by saying, good morning, beautiful, because you are beautiful. And I wanted you to hear it from me, wanted you to know it first from me. I wanted those words to be so embedded in you that you would never, ever doubt it, no matter who or what told you otherwise. I was not a perfect mother, Lena. I didn't know anything about these fat body movements or whatever you call it, and I didn't have blogs to read because there were no blogs and there were no support groups for mothers with overweight daughters. So I am sure I could have done some things differently, but I loved you. I loved you well. That ought to count for something.
Nice. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I was struck right there. I couldn't help comparing Honey's very genuine affirmation of her daughter's beauty with mm-hmm. the condescending comments that the woman made in the medical office. She felt compelled to,
yeah,
you know, that was really illuminating. So it's a vulnerable passage. There are a lot of vulnerable passages as part of the strength of the novel. And you have talked about the challenges when writing of being vulnerable on the page. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a challenge that many established writers face, but also aspiring writers, right, who are sitting mm-hmm. down at their desk trying to tackle these same projects, and they're running up against, oh man, I have to be vulnerable here, and this is going to be difficult. So how did you engage with that difficulty and overcome it enough to do what you wanted to do in this book?
So the good thing is that I was writing this without anybody knowing. So I didn't have the pressure of a deadline. Nobody was asking, oh, can I read a few pages? When are you going to be ready to show it? When are you going to share? I didn't know. My agent didn't know. Nobody knew. So I really could take my time. I could take breaks when I needed to, and I did need to just take a break from it because sometimes it was a lot. It was too much. So there was that. And then I just, you know, I felt like if I'm going to do it, I need to do it. I need to really push myself. And so I would. I would push myself to go to places and then promise myself that in the rewrite, I could take it out if I didn't want to leave it. So I would just write some really hard scenes and know that I could go back and revise it and craft it. Sometimes you just have to let the emotion of a thing out. And then you can go back and be the writer when you're, you know, figuring out how am I going to make this a work of art and a true story and not just my journal entry or my diary. But sometimes to get to the craft of writing, you have to do the emotional part of it first. So I gave myself permission to put it all out there, knowing that I would go back and take out and form and shape it. And so, yeah, what you have here is what was formed and shaped after drafts of a lot of raw scenes and emotion. So I just gave myself permission to do that. And then the practical stuff is, I have a very good community of other writers who love me and who will go on a long walk with me and we'll talk through the plot or not. Sometimes it's like, I need a break from even thinking about it. Can we just talk about something else? Mm-hmm. And I just do the things that I need to do. Listen to music, go to museums. Like sometimes I think we think, I had to be a writer, I have to write every day for a certain amount of time. But sometimes being a writer is letting yourself rest and letting yourself take in other art so that you have something to say when you go back to the page. Mm-hmm. So I do a lot of that too.
Okay. One of the other, there's so many what I consider points of entry in the book, you mm-hmm. know, different places where a reader could find their way into the text and mm-hmm. just sort of wander around and get connected. So one of the ones we haven't really touched on much so far, and I'm trying to avoid quoting from the book because you're quoting from it so well when you read to us. So I don't want to repeat what you're saying to us. But just one quick aside, I was talking to a couple of women about your book yesterday in mm-hmm. Roxbury and said, well, yeah, what's it like? And I said, well, it's eminently quotable, right? There's just a lot of, like, what is the one? I never go out of the house unless I'm casket ready or something.
Yeah, I always leave the house casket
ready. I thought that was great. But anyway, that's not what I want to ask you. Sorry. So Lena, at first in the doctor's office, she has this wonderful monologue where the nurse is talking about, you know, compiling a medical history. Mm-hmm. And Lena kind of goes off in a different direction in her head about what history actually is, mm-hmm. right? And so one of the things she talks about is the damage that incomplete histories can impart, right? And she also talks about how, you know, there's wisdom passed down from generation to generation, but there's other ideas that aren't so wise
right.
that also get passed
yes,
down
for
from
sure.
generation to generation. So while she's talking about these things in the book, she's also working on a history reclamation project mm-hmm. In Portland as the novel progresses. Now, did you realize that, considerations of history were going to play such a large role in the novel when you began it? Or was it something that emerged as you began to write?
So it emerged. So Lena is a librarian, and she's doing a project called Black Portland that's going to be an exhibit for the community. So she's doing a lot of research on Black history and the Black history of the Pacific Northwest and in Oregon. So if you know my work at all, you know that is something that I am always exploring. I think a lot of Black folks in the Northwest feel kind of erased from Black history. We talk a lot about the Great Migration from the South to the North, and there was not a lot taught to me about what happened to folks in the Pacific Northwest. So that was intentional. I did not know it was going to really be so much. Like I was a mention, and then all of a sudden I was like, well, what is she learning? And then I started learning things alongside Lena, and I was like, oh, this has to go in the book. And it just felt like deepened the story. If she's thinking about legacy, what's been left for her, what her grandmother left, what her mother left, then I'm just, well, who else left something? And I say, when I'm talking to young people especially, I'll say, you might feel like you don't have anyone in your immediate family, or your, I hope you do, or at your school or at your church, people you know up close and personal who can mentor you or guide you. But you do have your ancestors. We have on record the stories of people who survived very hard things and who triumphed and invented things. Like, that's your legacy. So you don't know them. They didn't know you. They didn't know you by name, but they had you in mind. They prayed you into existence. That is your legacy. So she's thinking about those people, too. The Black Portlanders who came before her, who kind of built the city. She's learning about that. And I wanted Portland to feel like a character. I also think, I was saying, I know who you are by your crew. I also think where we grew up is what made us. And so to really know my character, I need to know where she lives. So Portland became a character and not just the setting. And so if it's a character, it needed a backstory. So I wanted to show kind of the making of Portland and what is the backstory of Black Portland and how does that impact the now. I had no idea we would be going through the book banning stuff that is, you know, resurfaced now and all of the erasure of Black history and all of that work. She is a DEI program director. I didn't know this would be back at the forefront of our minds and in the conversation when I was working on the book. So it is kind of eerie that was in there before it became a thing we were talking about again. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know this better than me, but I just didn't recall, besides your work, encountering much African-American literature that's in that setting.
I felt erased. And even the books that took place in Portland, in the neighborhood that like my aunt lived in, the Black folks weren't there. And so, yeah, I want to make sure that, first and foremost, that the Black folks in Portland feel seen and validated, and that I always jokingly say, we're everywhere. Black folks are everywhere. But when people meet me and they find out that I grew up in Portland, that's like the first thing they say is like, I ain't no Black people. I'm like, yes, we're everywhere. And then I joke and say, well, but now that I don't live there full time, nobody else is there, you know. So
when I think of writers, and I hope you'll talk about this a little bit, is that this is your first novel that's aimed at an adult readership. Mm-hmm. And when I think of American writers who write successfully to various age groups, I think of people like you, Jacqueline Woodson, Jewel Parker Rhodes, right? So it's like a pantheon of really gifted writers. And so you touched on this a little bit, but I'd like for you to talk a little bit more, if you can, mm-hmm. about how you decide who the audience is for the project that mm-hmm. you're working on, and also what form it's going to take.
So with this book, I think I was just ready as a writer to be in conversation with adults. I've been talking to young people for a little over a decade now about these same themes, what's left for them, intersectionality, beauty, body image, self-love, all of that. And I want to talk to the folks who are raising them and nurturing them and loving them and teaching them. So it very much feels like a Renee Watson book in that way, and the themes are very much the same. But I just wanted to talk about what we are doing and not doing for and to our young people and be in conversation about that. And then explore what it is like to date at 40. There's a lot of love. This is also a love story. There's a love triangle. Like, I wanted to just talk about some adult things that I could not and would never put in a young adult novel or a middle grade novel. So part of it is, what do I want to be in conversation about? When, you know, you go on tour, you're going to be talking about these characters, these themes. So it's what I care about is what I write about. I don't ever want to write about something I don't care about. I don't want to write about characters who are not moving me. So that, I think, is first and foremost. I meet a character and I care about them, so I want to tell that story. And if the themes feel like this is a conversation I want to have with second graders, I want them to understand they can be like Florence Mills and use their voice to bring change. And it doesn't have to be making a speech. It can be singing. It could be art. That's for the second grader, third grader story, you know? And if I want to tell a story about how do you forgive complicated people? How do you hold that you can be the person who hurts and the person who heals? Like, I want to have that conversation with grown folks. So I just think about it in that way. Yeah.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Totally. Okay. And I don't want to impose on you, but I wanted to ask you, would you be comfortable with reading another passage?
Yeah.
It's your call. But I think we enjoy hearing your voice. And
There's a short that I can read, talking about daughterhood, motherhood. So we heard what Honey says to her daughter, Lena. Now Lena is talking to Aaliyah in a moment that is pretty heartbreaking. Aaliyah is trying to figure out, how do I remain whole in a world that's trying to break me? I feel like, especially when I'm talking to young girls, there's this assumption that, oh, they have low self-esteem and they need to just believe in themselves, and, you know, and I'm like, well, also, I think we come into this world whole. Like, we come believing that we are anything that the loving adults in our lives tell us we are. Beautiful, smart, capable, all of those things. And you go out into the world, and the world tells you, no, not that hair texture is not. Not that width of body. Not that neighborhood. Not that area code, you know? So I think Aaliyah is figuring out, and trying to figure out, who is telling her the truth. Her mama and her grandmother and her auntie are telling her all these affirmations, and when she goes to school, she is learning something different. And how do you hold on to the truth that you know is true, and how can that anchor you? So she's asking that question in an 8-year-old kind of way. And her mother, Lena, writes her this letter. Dear Aaliyah, believe the women who are still able to laugh even after loss and famine and drought and heartbreak. Trust the ones who know how to nurse a wound, who know something about the time it takes for hurting to heal. Believe me when I say you have to hold on tight to yourself. Keep your mind anchored to what you know is true. The anchor is me, is Honey, is Aunt Aretha, is every black woman who came before you and survived. They are holding you too. Their know-how, they're not gonna let nobody turn us around, their loudness, their bigness, their pride. Believe those voices above all other voices. Believe that it's not your responsibility to make anyone see your worth. You just be every bit of brilliance and beauty you are. Just because they don't believe you, don't mean it's not true.
Yes. And I think that illustrates one of the points you were making earlier about you don't want to preach to your audience. You put it in the mouth of a character.
Yeah.
It becomes dialogue as opposed to just the author saying, you need to do this.
Yes.
And that, that was really effective. Thank you for sharing that with us. Because you have more than 20 books to your credit, I imagine you working all the time. You said a little bit about you go to a museum or you listen to music, blah, blah, blah. I want to hear a little bit more about that, because I read your stuff and I'm like, what does downtime look like for her? Is there such a thing as downtime for her?
There is such a thing. Okay. Yes, there is. Downtime looks like folks coming to my home. I like to cook. I like to have them over. I love live music, live theater. I really do take care of myself. So even on a tour, I'll have a day off. I'm not constantly doing things. I like to just sit and be, and I really do. I get a lot of rejuvenation from being around people who I know love me. So we don't have to go do anything. Just come over and just sit, and we're just going to talk and catch up. That is the best afternoon for me. So I'm not always on the go, but even when I am, I make sure that I have those check-ins with friends so I can keep myself grounded and just, like, you know, anchored to something. So, yes, I do rest. I do have fun. I don't think I could write as much as I write if I wasn't engaging with the world, because then what would I be saying? So a lot of these books are in response to the life that I'm living.
So are you working on multiple projects at once?
Yeah. So what that looks like is I can be creating something and editing something at the same time if they are different age groups. So I can be writing a young adult novel, copy editing the picture book, because those voices are so different that I can keep that separate. I don't think I've ever worked on like two middle grade novels at the same time. So I juggle projects, but they're always in different, I can do a poetry collection and a novel because they're so different. And then if I do feel like, this character sounds like the character from another book, then I'm like, I need to take a break and I need to, you know, not be working on both of these books. But something's always on the back burner. I think like this, I mean, it was a play before. These characters have lived with me for years, just simmering on the back burner. And you know what that, like a good crock pot kind of story, just letting it simmer. I needed to grow. I needed to live some more life. So I think, yes, there are ideas I have now that I know I'm not ready to write yet. So I'm just kind of taking notes and just thinking it through. And I might not write that story for 5 more years, and I'm working on something right now, you know? Mm-hmm. I just always have ideas in my mind, and then some things I'm actually cooking and putting on the plate. But some things are still just marinating a little bit.
So when this was simmering, how was it simmering? Was it like, was Lena occasionally making some observation and you took note of it?
Yes. I have a friend who's in the audience, and I would tell her, like, we would be talking about dating, being single. Are you going to get on the apps or not? What are we going to do, you know? And I would, that's going in the book. Like, I would say, sometimes something would happen, and I'd be like, I got to write that down because this is going to go in the story. Or I knew I would need to research something. I'd hear this little whisper about Black history something in Portland. And I'm like, wait, what? I didn't know that. And I would make a note that I need to go find out more about Vanport or something that happened. So yes, I really was taking notes. I did not know when I would write it, but I knew that these characters were going to come back in some kind of way. So I have a tiny, it's really little notebook that I carry with me everywhere. Or, you know, I get new ones after they fill up, but they're small so that I can have them with me. And I'm always just taking notes. When I have an idea that needs to sit for a while, I'll go back to that notebook, and I'm like, oh yeah, I'm gonna put this in there, you know.
Fascinating. So I don't want to go anywhere near how the novel ends because I don't want to spoil it, right?
Yeah, thank you.
Right. So let's not do that. But I am curious, without saying anything, at what point in the process do you have an idea how it's going to conclude? Or does that happen really early? Or how does that work?
It never happens early. I'm not that writer that knows the whole story right away. Okay. I was like, what am I going to do? I got this girl in this situation, and I'm not sure how I'm going to get her out of it. So, yeah, I did a lot of brainstorming and just kind of soul searching to think about how I wanted it to end. And also, once I realized I realized what was going to happen, that came a little earlier. But then it's the how. How am I going to get this resolved? What's realistic? What is? And I don't want to only write what's realistic. I always say, as a fiction writer, I think part of my job is to tell the truth about what's happening. I write realistic fiction. It needs to feel real. It needs to reflect life. But I also want to imagine what could be. And I want to be right in the sweet spot of like, yeah, maybe we don't know. This feels very familiar, but hopefully it also feels like, oh, I didn't think it would end this way, or I didn't know that this could be the way a man shows up for a woman. Like, I didn't ever think about this. So I'm thinking of all of that when I'm coming to the page for the ending and how I'm going to resolve things. The relief in adult is that I did not have to neatly tie everything up. There were some things I could leave a little more like, I don't know how it's going to end. Or you might know as the reader, but I don't need to spell it out for you. And I think in children's literature, I definitely want to have things a little more closed for them so they're not left open emotionally and wondering about a character and if they're going to be okay. Mm-hmm. So I felt like I could play around a little bit with some of these characters where you don't know because I told you, but you might know because you feel it. You feel that they're going to be okay or that this is going to end up in a particular way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
During our conversation, you kind of touched on certain things. You've made reference to editors. You've made reference to an agent. And so take us way back to a different point in your career before those were words that commonly emerged during conversations about what you were doing. I feel like it's been a while because it's been more than 20 books.
Yeah.
And you're Renee Watson now. So before you were Renee Watson, and you were just like, I got this manuscript. What am I gonna do?
Yeah.
This is my goal, and I want to be out here in the world with my work. How did that begin for you?
I've always been a writer. I wrote a 21-page story when I was 7 years old, and my teacher was like, I think you're gonna be a writer one day. And
do
I
you still have it?
I don't have it,
oh,
but
man.
I do have stories from that time, but
okay.
I don't have that one.
Mm-hmm.
I have this book that I made, I think I was in the fifth grade, that the spelling and the handwriting. I just like, thank you teachers and educators who love us and love our children, and who would read through all of that and say to a child, I think you're gonna be a writer one day, and encourage my mother to get me journals. So the Renee before books was Renee writing books.
Mm-hmm.
When no one was paying attention and when I didn't know anything about book contracts and agents and all of that, even in college, I didn't go to school for creative writing. I went for creative arts therapy and how we use the arts to help kids cope with trauma. That's what I studied. And I wrote a book as an assignment for class. And my teacher, who was an author and illustrator, and another classmate in that classroom, they were the ones who encouraged me to pursue publishing. But I knew I would always be a writer, no matter what. I was doing one-woman shows and open mic nights, and I had a little critique group. We weren't even sending our work out. We were just sitting around writing and reading each other's works and giving each other feedback. So I say this to say, love the craft before any contract comes. Be good at the work first. I think that is first and is so important to just love words and to be a good literary citizen. Go to other folks' readings. Be a part of the writer community. And when the opportunity comes for you to publish and tell your stories, I think you'll be more ready. You don't have to get ready. When I published my first book, that was a classroom assignment, my editor said to me, well, do you have anything else? And I was like, oh, yeah. Because I had been writing for years. My first two novels, What Mama Left Me and This Side of Home, those were both short stories that I wrote, one in high school that I had saved, This Side of Home, and What Mama Left Me was actually not a short story, it was a play. So I always keep your stuff, study the craft, get better at it, be good when no one's watching and no one knows your name. And hopefully when those opportunities come, all that hard work and then the opportunity, you know, grow into the career that you want to have. So yeah, I was always a writer and I was always a reader, an avid reader, and rereading the same thing over and over. Like House on Mango Street is one of my favorite books. And I go back to it time and time again when I'm stuck. I go back to it when I need inspiration. So all of that was very much a part of me before I got published.
Undoubtedly, people are returning to some of your works over and over.
I hope so.
So how does that feel?
It's not lost on me that people bear witness with me. I think reading is a form of listening. And even if you don't identify with Lena, you don't look like her, you don't come from where she comes from, if you pick up the book and read it, you are saying to me that the story that I wrote matters and that these character stories matter and you are practicing empathy. And I think that that's really important. And so it's never lost on me that someone takes the time to be with my words and that we can be in conversation with each other. So yeah, it is the best compliment to me is when someone says, not just that they read it, but they read it again. I'm like, what? Or that they're arguing about characters. Like, it's so real to you that you have emotions about what's happening, that's always rewarding. It makes me feel really good. Yeah.
So we probably should be wrapping things up because we're having this great conversation. But I did want to ask you very quickly, I know you're touring to support Skin and Bones right mm-hmm. now, but that's not the only project that's out right now, right?
Yeah, on the same day, a picture book, Summer is Here, came out. So I'm at the very opposite ends, right? Summer is Here is a book about the first day of summer and a little girl just enjoying all that summer brings, and that came out May 7th as well. So I am celebrating both of those books right now.
And we're celebrating with you, and
thank
so
you.
Grateful that you're making the work that you make, the art that you make, and that you're sharing it with us.
Thank you.
So thank you, and thank you for this conversation, and thank you
thank
all.
You for being here.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.